Welcome back to Everything is Public Health. I'm MJ.
And I'm Cass.
Cass, you're famously gluten-free, a somewhat rare but well-known dietary condition for many Americans nowadays. Another common dietary condition is being lactose intolerant, i.e. the inability to digest, you know, dairy products. How are you with milk?
Usually fine.
Okay.
You know, if I like drank a giant glass of milk, I'd probably have a little bit of upset stomach. But like I can eat ice cream, I can cheese, all that kind of stuff. I'm usually fine, which is good because if I couldn't eat cheese and I couldn't eat gluten, it would make me very sad.
What's the largest amount of ice cream you've eaten in one setting?
I've certainly at least crushed a whole pint of ice cream. At least. I probably have done more than that at some, because you know, sometimes you go to the fair or you go somewhere and you get a giant bowl or whatever.
Did anything happen after you eat a whole pint of ice cream?
No, usually I'm fine. I don't have lactose intolerance. Again, if I drank like a whole glass of milk, I might get a little bit of an upset stomach, get some burps or something.
I, to this day, don't know if I have lactose intolerance or not. All I know is that one time I ate a pint of ice cream and it was an absolute disaster the day after. But I don't know whether that qualifies as lactose intolerant or just probably shouldn't do that. You know, you probably shouldn't eat a pint of ice cream.
You know, that's a good question. Like, do you drink milk?
Not on a regular basis, but when I do, it's fine. But when I consume a large amount of ice cream, it's not fine. So I'm not sure whether it's just ice cream. I don't know. But it's a very common dietary restriction for many. And I wouldn't say it's that serious, at least not compared to something like celiac. Like, you might get GI problems. You might have like gas, which is very common. But, you know, people don't. What's the right word? People don't.
Right. So I think the difference perhaps between lactose intolerance and celiac disease, is, which is an autoimmune disease, is when you eat gluten, your body literally attacks itself.
Yeah. Hate it.
And you have higher rates of intestinal cancer, stomach cancer, failure to thrive, like kids who have undiagnosed celiac.
Oh, it's awful. Yeah,
it's, there's some real problems. So while lactose intolerance, like, I don't want to minimize it at all, it is miserable. I know people who have it, and even if they take the little pills when they try to eat something, like, it still can be quite unfortunate and not fun because cheese is delicious.
Yes, cheese is delicious. We can agree with that. So we're talking about milk today because it's probably the food item that's most popularly associated with the topic of the day, which is called pasteurization. Cass, tell me everything you know about pasteurization.
So pasteurization...
Without guessing.
No, I'm not guessing. I was a biology major. I know about pasteurization.
Yeah. Yeah, tell me.
So pasteurization, the goal of pasteurization is to remove bacteria and other things from milk that may make people sick. There's this whole raw milk craze, which is problematic because it can make people
sick.
Already,
you know where this is going, but continue.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't. Great foreshadowing.
Yeah.
So pasteurizing, it's about, it's not really cooking, but like you heat it at a low temperature for a long period to try to kill the bacteria. And that way, one, it's safer to drink, and two, it usually lasts longer.
Yeah.
Did I miss any big parts of pasteurization?
No, actually, you hit all the main points. And you even hit the point that a lot of people don't realize, which is pasteurization is not boiling.
Oh, no, right.
If you boil it. Specifically not boiling.
Yeah, boiling milk is usually bad. You scald the milk and then it's not great. I bake a lot, right? So you don't want to scald the milk.
You don't. Because the idea of heating things up to like clean, quote unquote, clean things, that part isn't particularly revolutionary. What's revolutionary about pasteurization is that you don't have to boil it. That's the whole point, because a lot of things, when you boil them, turns into something else, right? So we want to avoid that boiling process. This is something that we're not going to get into, but there's actually multiple types of pasteurization process. It's an umbrella term that just covers this thing of like removing microorganism and, you know, sometimes enzymes too in the food product, so they could, one, be safer, and two, have a longer shelf life. But there's multiple different types of ways. They actually found ways to do it without using heat, which is kind of neat. The general idea of pasteurization, it's special because the temperature used is lower than boiling and it's done for an extended period of time. And why don't we want to use higher temperatures? We talked about this already, because for some food, it means you will cook it. What does cooking milk does? I don't bake.
So depending on how much you cook it, but like if you were to boil milk,
yeah,
you scald it and then parts of it separate out.
Ooh, really?
And it tastes awful. Like you basically can't use it after you have scalded milk. Yeah. So if you're like making pudding, for example, you need to keep the heat super low. You want to warm it, because warming, sometimes it helps things dissolve. Sometimes it helps things emulsify, etc. And then when you cool it back down, it can set firm, right? Because you've heated up the gelatin in the pudding, for example. If you've never scalded milk, it is a smell that you won't forget. And it's such a pain in the to clean up. Milk scalds so fast and it turns black and gunky, coats the outside. So I will say, full disclosure, there are some recipes that will say like, you need scalded milk, but you scald it for like a second so quick. You're like on and off the heat because you just want to get it to the point where it's like brown butter.
Brown and burnt butter right? are like very different.
You want
different.
Brown butter, but you don't want burnt butter.
Exactly. So that's what pasteurization is. You don't flirt with the higher temperatures to keep the, you know, the nutritional property the same and also the taste the same. But you also get the benefit of killing some microorganism that's really bad for being in something like milk. Spoiled milk smells really bad. So we want to avoid having spoiled milk. Now, I didn't know you could scald milk. This is something that I learned today because I've never once thought to myself, I want to heat up milk at any point in my life. So
you need to bake more.
Yeah, I should. Baking's too, like, too much numbers and I'm not a fan of that. But anyway.
Baking is a science. Cooking is an art.
Yes, I like art more than I like science, but just not with my food, I guess. History time. So how does pasteurization came to be? So since time immemorial, humans have known that food goes bad.
Right.
And since time immemorial, humans have known that they don't want food to go bad. They're trying to, you know, make food last as long as possible for obvious reasons. Because can you imagine that you have to eat everything that you find and hunt right away?
It'd be hard.
That sucks. That sucks.
Yeah. And like, how do you then store up for
winter?
You know, lean times when, you know, it's winter. You're not finding berries in winter.
Yeah, exactly. Feast and famine, not a fun place to be in. And they very quickly found various ways to keep food from going bad. And some of which, actually a lot of which, we still do today in some form. Just, you know, science-fied, if that's a word.
Yeah, so like we still dry things to make jerky, dry cured salamis, those kinds of things. We use heat to cook things out, whether that's canning, for example, jarring things. Pickles, love pickles. Although I saw this.
Please enlighten us.
On social media. It was a woman holding like mini cucumbers, like baby cucumbers, and being
cornichons.
Like, no, not that small, but like just small,
okay,
cucumbers.
Just small cucumbers.
And she was like, we pickle so many things. Why don't we pickle cucumbers?
Oh, no. Oh, no, woman.
It was like one of those reaction videos where then like people were
stitching
it.
Yeah.
Like people just were like so floored. Like a pickle is a cucumber.
They look the same,
like,
woman.
Why don't we pickle cucumbers? We do. It's called a pickle.
Yeah.
But then, like, you know, we pickle all sorts of things. I actually just pickled some onions the other day.
Onions, also a great choice.
And we wanted it kind of have a sweetness, but not be sweet. And so I have a little bit of bourbon maple balsamic vinegar that I added in with the regular vinegar to kind of give it a little
cast. No one likes to show off.
And then salt is a common thing too, right? You can salt cure things. Just moving on. Salt cure
many different ways.
You know, so there's lots of ways that we can make food last longer, which can help for all the reasons that we already discussed.
Because it sucks to have to eat things right away.
And you don't want to eat things that have gone bad. That is real bad.
Also really bad. People knew for a long time that heating and then immediately isolating the food keeps it from spoiling. So we actually discovered, well, I don't want to say canning, but the prototype of canning and jarring long before pasteurization. We know that if we heat something up and then we immediately trap it somewhere, it will last for a long time. And this was even before germ theory. And people for the longest time knew about this, and they thought that what spoiled something is the air, like exposure to the air,
miasma.
Right? Miasma theory of disease, like by exposing it to the air, things go bad. Then came Louis Pasteur, the hero of our story, who did a groundbreaking experiment, most frequently referred to as the swan neck bottle experiment. Cass, are you familiar with this?
Yes, but not familiar enough to describe the experiment.
Sure. So let's put on our scientist hat. You know, I'm going to put mine on. And you put yours on. So Louis Pasteur wants to prove that it's not exposure to the air that spoil things, but things in the air that spoil things. So he needed to come up with a way to expose food to air, but not have it spoil, essentially. Because then you can prove that the air itself is not the problem, but things in the air is the problem.
Yeah, so you would want to create some setup where air can get in and out, but stuff can't.
Exactly. Very smart.
Yeah, and that's right. That's where the swan neck comes in, because air could move through, but any particles would get trapped.
A less smart person like me would be like, okay, we need this complicated filter system that allows air molecule to move through, but prevents everything else from moving through. But Louis Pasteur, being a smart guy, is like, well, no, let's just get a bottle with a very, very long neck. And then the neck bends in a certain way that there's no way for any particles in the air to get past that U-bend. But air, being air, can still move through. And that's exactly what Louis Pasteur did. He took a bottle, he boiled whatever is in that bottle for a very, very long time, guaranteeing that it kills everything. Instead of leaving the bottle open, he used this swan neck approach to have this very long neck to the bottle and bend it in a U-shape so that it still has contact with the air, but not contact with particles in the air. And guess what? The thing never spoiled, thus proving it is not air itself. What I think is really amazing is that this was before germ theory. He did this before proving germ theory of disease, but what's also surprising is that after this, people still didn't realize it was germ theory of disease. It took more time for people to realize that it was germs. So I don't know what people thought after this experiment. They just thought maybe, I don't know.
Well, then still, it's like it's miasma.
Right.
Right. So, okay, it's not all air is bad, but there's like patches of air that are bad.
However they conceptualize patches of air.
Right? Man, that was almost a spit take. I really thought you were going to spray your water there for a second.
Yeah, I was drinking water. So after that, groundbreaking in the field of biology. However, common misconception. That is not the experiment that led to pasteurization. That's Louis Pasteur's most famous experiment, but that is not his pasteurization experiment. So the same guy later did the pasteurization experiment, which goes as follows. He likes wine, and he thinks wine goes bad too quickly.
Yes.
So his experiment was motivated by his desire for wine. So.
Yeah, because if it lasts longer, it'll be cheaper and easier to transport.
Yes, and you can age it for longer if it doesn't go bad.
Yep.
And he's like, well, man, I really love my wine, but these things keep spoiling on me. Well, we can't boil wine. Actually, can we? What does boiled wine taste like?
So again, you don't want to boil wine, because if you boil it, you boil off the alcohol.
Oh, that's right.
Instead, you might mull wine. So same thing, like you would put it on a low enough heat to warm it up, but not allow it to boil. Because as soon as it boils, then everything evaporates. The same way you would with milk. If you haven't had mulled wine in the winter, it's quite delightful.
I have not.
You put like cinnamon sticks or cloves
something
to kind of give it a
wintry,
like, Christmassy vibe.
Yeah, winter into a spiced wine. Do you think at this point mulled wine was a thing?
Oh, that's a good question. I would have to say yes. I would think so.
Yeah, right? So maybe he got the idea from mulled wine. And he's like, well, I'm going to gently heat the wine, not to a really high point, but for a longer duration of time. And because of my last experiment with the swan neck bottle, I'm going to isolate it from the air in the process.
Yeah, so mulled wine, I just did a quick Google because like this had to have been around for a very long time.
It must be, yeah.
Yeah, 20 AD,
okay.
When the first traces of mulled
people
wine.
People knew about heating wine, but that's not boiling it. Okay, cool. So yeah, he did this. And this is the pasteurization experiment of like, if you can just heat something to a certain level that's not boiling for a longer period of time, it will not kill everything, but it will significantly extend the shelf life and significantly sterilize, well, sterilize is the wrong word, but you know, clean a beverage in that way. And thus, the pasteurization process was named after him because he discovered this process called pasteurization that people later adapted into many different things.
Pretty baller to have something like this that is so important
named after you.
Yeah. Sometimes I think about as awful as it would have been to live in a time when, you know, didn't know what was killing you and maybe you lived until you were 40, if you were lucky. There were so many things that we didn't know. You had the potential to have something really meaningful named after you. Like,
yes.
Every year, every day, there are fewer and fewer things to discover.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, sometimes I think back, man, you could like really have done some cool stuff because nobody knew anything.
Exactly. Do you know how hard it is to make a name for yourself in academia today? It's impossible, people. It's impossible. Another misconception, just to wrap up the history section. Pasteurization was first intended for alcohol, like Louis Pasteur wanted to do. Milk was not pasteurized until much, 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 much later. People only use this for alcohol for a very long time. Why didn't they think of using it for other things? I don't know. You ask them and they're all dead. So anyway, aside from preserving food for longer, why is pasteurization public health?
Oh man, it's so good for public health because as we talk about, public health is about a population level strategy to try to improve the health of everybody. And if you say milk must be pasteurized, One, again, it's going to last longer. It'll be more accessible.
Yeah.
But it will also not kill people.
Yes.
Or make people really sick, right? So food poisoning is a huge problem when food goes bad or if it's not sort of stable for long enough. You know, pasteurization minimizes food poisoning and it can also then minimize spread of infectious diseases. So thinking about the types of infections or diseases we've talked about before that spread via food, Salmonella, Campylobacter jejuni, some of these other things that can spread through food. And then also you can potentially spread them to other people. And we pasteurize a whole bunch of stuff now, not just milk, but lots of things that people drink. Anything that's going to be bottled for a long time tends to be pasteurized. Because again, it is more cost effective to spend a little bit more money up front to make something last longer, meaning that it can go further, people can drink it for longer times, etc. But pasteurization is definitely a great public health win.
Yes. And we love pasteurization. It keeps everybody safe, or safer, I should say. And it's a truly one of the greatest public health invention is the wrong word, but I guess effort, I guess, to, you know,
innovation.
Make food safe for everyone. Yeah, innovation to make food safe for everyone.
Absolutely. And again, because everyone should be getting food that is pasteurized, you don't have to worry about human behavior to opt in to get the benefit. You may, based on the response you had when I mentioned raw milk, there are people who may opt out of things, which is not great, but at a minimum, you know, you don't have to opt in. The safest thing is the easiest thing.
Exactly. That's a common theme on the show. Well, now we get to the part of the episode that makes everything is public health, everything is public health. We're going to talk about something a little bit less positive. You mentioned raw milk. Where did you hear about the raw milk movement, by the way? Where did you hear about this?
So it had come across my social media a few times because, again, I do a lot of cooking and baking. So I follow a lot of food related things. And occasionally the algorithm will give me idiotic people talking about things like raw milk, usually, you know, because there's some funny response video to it, like the whole pickle thing. Why don't we pickle cucumbers? But I've also seen it in some TV shows recently where people are like basically smuggling raw milk and then getting in trouble for it because it's not good for people, or at least one, there's no known benefit to drinking raw milk. And two, there are lots of known harms that can come from drinking raw milk.
Exactly.
So it's generally not a great thing. But yeah, people have been making fun of it on social media, on television shows recently, like things I've been watching within the last year, probably social media a little bit longer than that. You know, it takes some time for TV to catch up. But
what show features raw milk?
Letterkenny.
Oh, actually, that makes total sense.
That makes total sense, right? Yeah.
Are they pro or against raw milk in Letterkenny?
I think against. But I was actually, the clip that was in my head that I was just thinking about smuggling raw milk, that was Schitt's Creek.
Also makes sense.
Yeah, because they were trying to make a quick buck. That was the one that was in my head. But, you know, because there's farmers and stuff, like they've talked about raw milk. And so that was, I guess that was a little bit further ago, a couple of years ago, I guess, for Schitt's Creek.
Yeah, Schitt's Creek ended a few years ago. But, you know, it's made a comeback, unfortunately.
Just like not getting the measles vaccine has made a comeback. And now look what's happening in Florida.
Right. Oh, man. Well, we don't talk about Florida.
It's not
anyway,
the Floridians' fault.
That's true.
It's not all their fault.
It's not all their fault. Yeah, and it's making a comeback, and maybe it shouldn't have made a comeback. And I believe, I don't know the specific, but I believe there are laws and regulations about whether you can sell raw milk. I think the only way to get it is you have to buy it directly from the farmer. Like, the farmer cannot put it up for sale in any market. I believe there are laws against it. But people go crazy over raw milk. Like Cass said, no proven benefits. Pasteurization does change the nutritional value of milk, but it's like a dent. It's like truly, the risk-benefit ratio is completely off, is what I'm trying to say. Your risk of getting infections from raw milk is so much higher than that whatever like 0.2 more protein or fat that you get from drinking raw milk, and it's just not worth it.
So I just did a quick skim because I wanted to make sure I wasn't talking out of school. So it does vary a little bit by state.
Of course
it
does,
some states have some regulations, but in Maryland, for example, retail sale of raw milk for human consumption is not legal.
Yeah, you have to buy it from the farmer. You can't put it up into a market. Yeah. So yeah, like don't do it. Last discussion point I want to have with you. What do you say to people who say, well, I've drank raw milk for such a long time and nothing ever happened? It's a very common, it's not just in milk, it's a very common public health barrier or challenge we deal with as public health people to answer these things. Insert whatever public health problem you want here, but what would you say to people who say, I've always drank raw milk and nothing's ever happened to me?
Well, one, I would say, yeah, people also didn't used to wear seatbelts and you were lucky to not have something bad happen to you. That's not necessarily a reason to do it. But I'm actually going to show you something, MJ. So I just did a quick CDC search on this and I want to share my screen with you. And I want to show you this map that I just found. The peach-colored states, the sale of raw milk is illegal. In the light blue states, the sale of raw milk is legal only on farms. And in the dark blue states, the sale is legal, just period. But then I'd like you to take notice of the black circles with white numbers in them. That's the number of foodborne illness outbreaks linked to raw milk. And what relationship do you see? And we can maybe put this link in the link
will.
In the show
notes. Yes, we definitely will.
But what do you notice? You know, there's some variation, but there is what I would say from an ocular test, a pretty clear relationship.
I think there is a pretty strong relationship between the color of the state and indicating whether sale of raw milk is legal and the number of related raw milk outbreaks. I don't know if it's completely linear. It seems to be maybe exponential. But there is a relationship.
Yeah. So just to describe it for anybody who doesn't have the time or patience to go out to the site, but we will put it in the show notes. In states where it is illegal between 2013 and 2018, I would say there was an average of mostly no outbreaks. The average being, you know, maybe one to two, but like three is the most outbreaks across that period in states where it is illegal. In states where it's legal only on farms, again, some variation.
Yeah.
Four is the highest number.
Yeah, one to two again.
But in states where sales are legal,
it's so high.
The average is probably closer to seven or eight, and the highest number is 14 outbreaks. So this does not account for state variation or state population, excuse me, which makes it even worse. I'm so bad at geography. So what state is that next to Nevada? So it's California, Nevada. What state is that?
Utah.
Is that Utah that has 14? So Utah does not have a giant population. So California has three, Utah has 14 outbreaks in that same period. And Pennsylvania has nine. And is that Ohio has seven? So there's clearly like in states where it is illegal to sell raw milk, there are few to no outbreaks. And in states where it is legal to sell raw milk, there are a lot too many outbreaks. Foodborne illness outbreaks specifically linked to raw milk.
Yes, not in general, specifically linked to raw milk. I think that's, we need to clarify that. And also, I feel like after you adjust for population, you can get a whole host of new correlation after you adjust for population, because California has three, but California's population is huge, whereas Utah has 14 and Pennsylvania has nine. So yeah, I mean, that's what I would also say, which is just because something doesn't affect you doesn't mean it's not a problem.
Well, that's like the core of public health, right?
Yeah.
Like, yes, we care about individuals. I don't mean to imply that what happens for an individual is not relevant. But just because you don't experience a thing does not mean that we should not take actions to protect that from happening among a broader group of people, aka everyone else. And I think there's been so many, like, sometimes it's celebrities, sometimes it's just like whatever random influencers who are putting out ridiculous things, bad information. Sometimes it's, I think, intentionally misleading to, you know, create profit. Sometimes I think people are just like buying into some stupid hype and profiting off of it. But there are so many people who really are not the kinds of people you should be listening to saying information. Now, I personally, I'm going to be very clear. This is my personal perspective. Don't sue the podcast. I think Dr. Oz is a total quack.
Oh, yeah. I stand by
that. And he
does
a disservice. I do not think he should retain his medical license. I think the information he is peddling out to people is causing... And now, I don't know if he's ever said something specifically about raw milk.
I stand by that firmly. Like, there has been many, many journalists who wrote many, many articles about the things that he says on his show that is just factually untrue, if not straight up dangerous. And he has a conflict of interest. He gets so much, so much money from people who put products on his show.
Yeah.
He is no longer an objective voice of science.
Yeah, he has a huge conflict of interest.
Exactly. So, well, to wrap that up, here's another unfun fact about milk. before milk was required to be pasteurized. Again, this is a public health thing to require pasteurization for milk. Huge innovation that made everybody's life safer. Before milk was required to be pasteurized by law, people would add things to milk to mask spoilage.
It's so gross. I wish people could see my face right now.
Do you know why they did it? This is a hypothesis, because it's cheaper to add something to milk than it is to pasteurize milk, because pasteurization would require like a much larger apparatus. So before it was required by law, they're just like, well, we're just going to make people think that milk doesn't spoil by adding something. It's so bad. Anyway.
Gross. Thanks for that gross lead out.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Everything is Public Health. If you like the show, please share it with your friends, family, and acquaintances. That is the best thing you can do to help us tell everyone how awesome and ubiquitous public health is.
Please follow us on Threads, Instagram, Mastodon, all at Everything is Public Health, and also Blue Sky Social at Everything is PH. We are no longer using Twitter. I'm actually starting to use Threads a bit more at CastPhD, and you can find me on the LinkedIn as well.
The LinkedIn? Just LinkedIn, I think. But anyway.
I also say you can find me on the interwebs. So, you can find me on the LinkedIn.
New episodes are released every Thursday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave us a rating and a review. It helps the show immensely. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or think we missed an important perspective, please reach out to us at everythingispublichealth@gmail.com.
If you want to support the show directly, we have a Patreon page, which also acts as our website. Follow us there for all major updates and bonus material. And remember, everything is public health.
Everything is public health.